Let's pray. Father in heaven, thank you so much for tonight. Thank you for this group that's gathered together to be around your word. I am so honored and grateful for each and every one of them. As we open the book of Judges and start digging into the Bible parts of it, thank you and give us great examples on how we might live our lives, both positively and things that we might avoid. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, does anybody have any thoughts or questions about what we talked about last week? Because we're going to get into the actual people this week, but kind of the overview and the stuff that we learned from last week. Anybody? We're all good on that? We're all okay? Good. All right. We will be needing to read the Bible here. So it is a Bible study, after all. I told you about the... Did I tell you about the... I have a friend of mine. There was a great Lutheran Bible teacher coming to my church, and from the upper Midwest even. He was coming to speak at my church in Virginia. And so I brought my Methodist friend along to hear this guy. And he had a Bible that had a zipper. You've seen the Bibles with the zippers, old stuff. And he held that up, and it was zippered the whole time. And my friend says, that guy talked, he's supposed to be a Bible teacher. He didn't unzipper that Bible once. And so he refers to the Lutheran church as the church of the zippered Bible, which, of course, irritates me no end. So, but you know, I have friends that do that to me. So, as I said, I come by it honestly. Let me turn to my notes where I need to be. We're going to pick it up with chapter 3. And what we're going to do tonight is we're going to look at some of the judges and kind of try to pick up some life lessons from them. Kind of interesting because some things are sometimes ridiculously short, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. Let's turn to Exodus. Let's not turn to Exodus. How about Judges? Judges chapter 3, beginning with, all right. Judges chapter 3, let's start with... the first guy, Othniel is how his name is pronounced. Chapter 3, verse 7. Go ahead and read. 3:7.
And the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord.
Are we hearing that?
There's some numbers displayed here.
If there are numbers displayed, you're being picked up, but we're not being heard. Jarl abandoned us. Anybody know how to turn the volume up on the deal? Dan, you want to try there? Go for it there. Just turn the volume up so that we can hear a little bit better. Yeah, you can hear just fine, I'm sure. I'll talk.
Test 1, 2, 3, 3, 2, 1.
Nope.
Test 1, 2, 2, 2, 2, 2. Testing.
1, 2, 1.
Hearing
two,
anything?
You got the money,
from
honey.
Judges, chapter 3.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Judges, chapter 3.
That doesn't work.
Starting at verse 7, Judges, testing.
Test. I'm getting kind of testy.
Getting very testy here, yes.
All right.
Test.
Still no better.
Testing. Nothing coming through.
If there are, they're on the back. Hand up.
Anything?
Well, do we need to make more?
Testing.
I'll see.
Testing.
There's one left, Ernie.
1, 2, 3, 3, 2, 1. Testing.
There's a stack.
Testing. Anything coming through yet?
Yes. Okay, let's just go
anyway.
Appreciate
you looking into it, Dan.
Have to. What's that? No, I don't think that's what the problem is. I think the
did that.
Jarl set the level for it to be recording, not necessarily to be heard in here.
Yeah.
It's recording.
Test.
Well, let's keep going anyway. Follow along as he reads anyway. We're just about there.
Oh. Well, I'll keep
talking.
It in front of my mouth.
We'll read, because it's
maybe
being recorded.
If it comes
that's
through,
all that matters.
It comes through?
I mean, the live audience is unimportant. Okay. Just go.
And the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord.
There we go.
They forgot the Lord their God and served the Baals and the Asherah. Therefore, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel.
Okay, remember, Baal is the bull-type consort, and Asherah is the gal with many breasts and very shapely hips, okay?
The anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel.
Now, that's a rotten thing for me to do, to have you read that guy's name.
And he sold them into the hand of
Cush-Rishathaim,
king of Mesopotamia.
Mm-hmm.
And the people of Israel served Cush and Rishathaim 8 years.
8 years.
But when the people of Israel cried out to the Lord raised up a deliverer for the people of Israel who saved them, Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother. The Spirit of the Lord was upon him, and he judged Israel. He went out to war, and the Lord gave Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Mesopotamia, into his hand.
Mm-hmm.
And his hand prevailed over Cushan-Rishathaim. So the land had rest 40 years.
Okay, this is just a little taste of, again, the cycle of sin, judgment, and grace. Okay, that's just a little foretaste of it, how it goes. Some of these judgeships are only going to be like one verse or two verses, but that's an interesting one to see the one verse or the two verses floating around out there. So that's just kind of a little test up there. In the meantime, let me see if I can just read aloud, because I am loud, and we'll try going from there. We're going to Ehud. Then the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord strengthened Eglon. I love that name, Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel because they had done what was evil in the sight of the Lord. He gathered himself the Ammonites and the Amalekites. Now, see, we've talked about the Amalekites before. If you've got an Amalekite problem, you need to get rid of the Amalekite problem thoroughly. Their problem is they are not getting rid of the Amalekite problem thoroughly, and so we have problems. Neither here nor there. Nevertheless, the Amalekites are there, and they went and defeated Israel. And they took possession of the cities of the palms, and the people of Israel served Eglon, the king of Moab, for 18 years. That's a long, long day. That would not be a lot of fun for 18 years. Then the people of Israel cried out to the Lord. There's the cycle again. And the Lord raised up a deliverer, Ehud, the son of Gera, a Benjamite. Okay, this is a different tribe. Now, here's an interesting thing. It says what next?
A left-handed
man. Are there any people who are left-handed in the room here? We have a show of hands. Keep the left-handed people stay, you know. My brother is left-handed, and he said that there are two kinds of people in the world, the left-handed and those who wish they were. If you are right-handed, you're the dominant, and this has been the case throughout history. It just always has been. In Latin, you say that someone can use both hands as what? And that means what? No, that's not what it means. This is interesting. Ambidextrous means you have two right hands. Because in Latin, the word for right-handed is dextrose, dexterity. And the word for left-handed, anybody know? No. Sinister. You know I love you anyway. It does explain a lot because it, curiously enough, gives you an unfair fighting advantage in a right-handed world, particularly if you're using swords. It gives you an unfair, because you can hold a right-handed person's hand of power with your left hand and with your right hand, and with your left hand, which is your hand of power, you can do them in. So you can come up and shake hands and then stab them with a knife. The word sinister, and that is where it comes from. I'm not making this up. You can look it up. You might sound like I'm making this stuff up, but again, we learn more here by accident than most places on purpose. That's not true. This isn't accidental. These are simply rabbit trails that we go down where we learn things from. So in any case, he's left-handed. And that's not a minor thing to say in this particular. It's not just thrown in there for good measure. So he's left-handed, and they cried out, and the people of Israel sent tribute to Eglon, the king of Moab, and Ehud made for himself a sword with two edges, a cubit in length, that's 18 inches. Now, this is the dirty, tricky part of him. And he bound it on his right thigh under his clothes. So it's on this side right in here, right there. So if he gets frisked on the outside, no one's going to find it there. And besides, they're going to be anticipating, they want to be frisking the other side, his left side, because that's where it would likely be. Okay, well, it's not there. So he gets this thing on there, and he presented the tribute to Eglon. Now, Eglon was a very fat man. And just kind of let you know that that, again, is not just thrown in there for whatever. In a time when people lived from subsistence, you know, basically scraped to stay alive, the only people that could afford to be overweight were people that were very, very, very wealthy. So this was uncommon, so it's kind of thrown in there. So it's kind of saying this guy was rich, and he was rich because of all the tribute that Israel had to bring to him. So here it gets kind of fun. It says, and when Ehud had finished presenting the tribute, he went away. The people carried the tribute, but he himself turned back at the idols of Gilgal and said, I have a secret message for you, O king. And the king commanded silence, and all his attendants went out from his presence. And Ehud came to him as he was sitting alone in the cool of the roof chamber. And Ehud said, I have a message from God for you. And he arose from his seat, and Ehud reached with his left hand and took his sword from his right thigh. So again, the sinister part of all this. And he thrust his sword into the belly, so that the hilt went after the blade. That's a lot of thrusting going in there, 18 inches of hilt going in, and the fat closed over the blade. Now, this is where it gets ugly. I'm not making this up. I don't make this stuff up. I truly don't. You know, I'm glad, but I do worry that, you know, the Facebook will light up and the Sainted Mrs. Cross will find out that I've been talking about fecal matter in... I'm just saying what it says in the Bible. Now, this guy was so overflowing with fecal matter. You might say that... Oh, no, I wouldn't say that. here's the thing. If you get stabbed and in the intestines and fecal matter oozes out of you, you must have a lot of fecal matter in you. I mean, I'm not making this up. It's in there. And it gets even funnier yet. So that's what happens. His belly and dung came out. They cleaned it up a little bit there. They don't clean up the fecal matter. They clean up calling it that. They just call it dung, I suppose. Does it say offal in the NIV? They use the word offal.
Dirt
in the NIV. No, that's
this is the
NRSV. Yeah, well, that's not a good Bible. So, that's right. That's fine. I'm just being bad. Yes, I am. It came out, and he closed the doors of the roof chamber behind him and locked them. When he had gone, the servants came and saw that the doors of the roof chamber were locked, and he thought, surely he is relieving himself in the closet of the cool chamber. Now, again, his servants are under the impression that, well, you know, that must be what he's doing. And the reason why they must feel that way is because he must be doing this a lot, which means this guy has the issue of gluttony. He eats and he eats and he eats and he eats. And ultimately, in this rather disgusting way, he is undone. Now, if you think I'm just being vulgar, to the prophet, Elijah the prophet, one of the good guys in the Bible, right? One of the good guys of the Bible, correct? Let's pick 1 Kings chapter 18. Prophets at Mount Carmel, the prophets of Baal versus the prophets of God. Oh, actually, Elijah. And there you see this rather curious contest that's going on. You know the one I'm talking about, where it hasn't rained for a long time, and we have a sacrifice, two equal sacrifices, one on the one hand for Baal, one on the other hand for the Lord. And he mocks the prophets of Baal, saying, "Where's your God? Is he out for a walk?" Now we've got it. Now I don't have to keep reading. Thank you, David, you're wonderful. I take back the bad things I said. But just the things I said today, though. Okay. Fantastic. You're wonderful. Did I say that already? Okay, great. In any case, at the prophets of Baal, he says, "Well, where is your God? Is he out relieving himself?" Well, you need to understand something. Hebrew is a very earthy language. And to say, "Is he out relieving himself?" nobody would say it quite that way. There would be some clever vulgarism that goes with that, because he is mocking Baal. And he says, "What's he at? Is he out on the, you know, fill in the blank?" Okay? So that's the kind of stuff that's going on. Now, again, I've said to you this before. These were originally oral accounts before they were written. And you can imagine them being told around the campfire. And you can imagine when it gets to this part, rather than people being very pious and, you know, straightening up their ties like they would in an old school Lutheran church, they're just laughing uproariously. They think that this is hilarious. I mean, it has some humor value that goes with it that makes it a particularly interesting story. That this guy's excess is ultimately his undoing. And I think that's something that we can learn from in life, is that sometimes our excesses, and sometimes when we particularly are acting in an oppressive way, that can be our undoing. We need to be careful about stuff like that. I mean, here's a guy that's oppressing the people of Israel, and ultimately this is what does him in. And just to let you know, there are four instances in this particular passage that highlight this guy, Eglon, and his problem with this. So I think that's particularly fascinating about this one. But my next one's my favorite. Would you mind reading there with verse 31 there? Of chapter 3.
After him was Shagmar.
I just love the name Shagmar. I mean, doesn't that sound like a great name? Shagmar. Okay, this is a guy, that's all there is we know about Shagmar. That's all there is we know about Shagmar. But there's something incredibly interesting here, and something that we can learn that's really important from a standpoint of a spiritual perspective. There's a historical thing here and a spiritual thing here. The historical thing here is this gives us an insight into the development of Israel at this particular time. Here's the guy who is the leader of Israel. He's the judge of Israel. And the best he can do to fight the Philistines is an ox goad. This, of course, is a farm implement. For those of you who have not grown up on a farm like me, not growing up on a farm. I did not grow up on with livestock. I did love that little joke about having livestock with the little thing that we saw on Sunday, the little video clip. That was hilarious. But nevertheless, not having livestock, I didn't know what a goad was until somebody told me. A goad is a very sharp stick with a nice point on it, sometimes with a nail on it. And when Jesus says to Paul in the vision, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? It hurts you when you kick against the goads." Now, I don't ever have even thought about this. How many of you would like to actually step on a nail? Anybody ever stepped on a nail? Stepping on a nail is not much fun, is it? It's a memorable experience. It is a memorable experience. Stepping on a nail is not much fun. Kicking a nail is really, I mean, think about that. Kicking a nail. The reason why that nail's at the end of the stick, it's to poke the ox to get it moving. I mean, ox is a big animal. You want to get it moving. Paul says, Jesus tells Saul, it hurts you when you kick against the goads. That's what it is when we try to fight Jesus. When we're resisting Jesus, it's about the same thing. It's about as useful for us as kicking against a nail. Not a good idea. I would strongly recommend anybody against fighting against Jesus in their lives. A very dumb idea. And again, wonderful metaphor. But let's go back to this. Here is this guy, Shamgar. I love just saying the name Shamgar. Here's this guy, Shamgar. An old Shamgar, all he's got is himself an ox goad. But with his ox goad, he goes out and kills 600 Philistines. Again, two things going on here. The first thing is, as I said, the state of the military technology of the Israelites is very low. Very, very low. And we will learn later on as we read through the Bible in when we get to 1 Samuel 13, verse 20. And in 1 Samuel 13, verse 20, we find out just how low the state of technology is. If they happen to have anything metal that needs to be sharpened, they have to take it to the Philistines because the Philistines are the ones that have the technology to make things sharp. Now, you know, it's great to have all sorts of weaponry. Let's just say you've got the coolest weaponry in the world, but the problem is you don't have any bullets. You've got to go to your enemy to get the bullets. Is that going to work? No, it's definitely not going to work. The Philistines have the metal technology. All Shamgar's got's an ox goad. But all the technology in the world's not going to help you if you've got God on your side. Shamgar overcomes a significant military force. He kills 600 of them. With significantly better technology, because he doesn't need that. He has God. And God is fighting that battle for him. And I think that's something that, there's a couple things that I think are important for us to remember. Number one is, you and God, if you're walking where God wants you to walk, if you're walking in the blessing of God, you are an immovable force. Not because of you, but because of God. Not because of you, but because of God. Which is why, you know, sometimes we pray, Lord, could you bless this? Well, the answer is, that's the wrong thing to pray. You should ask, Lord, what are you blessing, and help me walk in it. I think as a church for us, we need to pray that way too. Because sometimes we think, we've got all these great plans as a church. Well, are they great plans, or are they God's plans? And really, what we need to be praying as a church, as individuals, Lord, what are you blessing in this community, and how do you want us to walk as a congregation in that blessing? A different way to pray, because a lot of times we want to pray that God's going to bless things, which he just can't bless, you know?
I used to chuckle over Patrick Henry's speech.
Dan used to chuckle over Patrick Henry's speech.
Because the kids thought it was just too dramatic.
Just too dramatic.
Until you get to the line that says, besides, we shall not have to fight our enemies or fight the British alone.
Besides, we shall not have to fight the British alone.
God will raise up an army.
God will raise up an army. And he said that in a church, by the way. Yeah. He did, Patrick Henry. Put your hands over your heart because Patrick Henry is a son of the Commonwealth. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, indeed. I got to tell you something. This is funny. This is great. What's that Stephen Ambrose book? The Lewis and Clark.
Undaunted Courage.
Undaunted Courage. Okay. Rhonda is reading this right now. And she, I'm saying I can't wait for it to get done so I can start reading it. But there is one passage in there, and I can just see this, because I stood once in Sioux City overlooking the Missouri there, where is it Floyd, Sergeant Floyd Memorial. It's up high up on a bluff, and there out there you see the vast prairie before you, and you can imagine what that must have looked like for them. And Ambrose is describing the description that Lewis and Clark are giving, and sort of the irony of it all. He said that they talked about the bear and the bison and the antelope and the deer and all the bucolicness and the native people there, and they must have wondered why God should have put such a beautiful place outside of Virginia. Of course, I would. It was what a great line, though, as I said, that because really, I mean, Virginians are an odd people that way. So in any case, but nevertheless, Patrick Henry, yes, God fights for us. So there you go. But again, that's the thing. Be in the blessing of God. Walk in the thing that God is blessing and pray about that. God, what are you blessing? And then there's that sense of invincibility. That's the first thing that I want us to do. The second thing I want us to see is this. I think that's a pretty cool lesson, and otherwise skipped over only one verse about one guy, pretty obscure guy, pretty obscure verse. We should never despise the small and obscure things that we can find in Scripture. We should never despise the small and obscure things that we can find in Scripture, because there are many such passages that teach us valuable lessons about what it is to be a follower of Christ, about what it is. And so these are some of the things that we want to sit and sometimes not pass too quickly over. Not pass too quickly over or sort of scratch our head and say, well, that's an unpronounceable name. I'll just go on to the next one. I want to get to Samson, for crying out loud. I know about him. So these are some of the things that I want us to remember. And this is a good life lesson, a good biblical lesson, good spiritual lesson for us. We should not despise the small things of this world or the obscure things of this world. Because God uses... I'm going to tell you another great story. You've been there. Czechoslovakia, right? Who's the guy that was the pastor that... kept going on and on during the communist regime, kind of the father of modern Lutheranism there. What's his name? Yeah, that's the guy, yeah. Boda, yeah. Anyway, they didn't send him off to the gulag. They didn't send him off to the gulag, this Lutheran pastor in Czechoslovakia at the time. What they kept doing with him is they told him, now listen, you got to stop talking like this. You got to stop getting the youth involved in this sort of stuff. You just got to do it the way we do it, because I mean, they had their official people in the church. And so what they would do is they would put him in further and further remote places. But everywhere he would go, there was the remote place. Finally, they put him at the end of the bus line. That's how Adrian, is that how it pronounced? Adrian, that's how he said it. He said, they put him at the end of the bus line. Again, the most remote place that you can be. And the KGB doesn't even want to go out there. And what's he do? He has a revival out there. In this remote place. This is how God does things. I mean, it's so cool, because we think we need the size and bigness and this, that, and significance and acrylic podiums and all that sort of stuff. Acrylic podiums. You know, the ones that guys that have the bouffant hairdos that kind of have the floppy Bibles that preach on Sunday morning, guys like that. Guys that don't look like me. The guys that I envy tremendously. No, simply because they're here. Anyway, so, but again, never despise the small thing.
The mention of they were the servants of this ruler.
They were the servants, yes.
Counted as a captivity.
Yes, okay. Vassal. Dan asks... See, I'm being good now. See, I'm repeating the question for power, the powers that be. Do you hear that, Charles? I'm repeating the questions. The idea of vassalhood, think of it like this. How many people are from Moorhead here? Any Moorhead type? Okay, I'm safe to talk then. I know there's some people from Grand Forks, though, and some people from Hatton, even. Is that correct? Is it
Northwood.
Northwood, not even Hatton. So, but let's just say I am the king of Fargo. And as the king of Fargo, my troops have imposed a tariff, and the tribute must be paid by the people of Moorhead, and they are now my vassals, okay? And they must pay tribute to the king of me, the king of Moorhead. And then I'm going to say to my vassals in Moorhead, along with the people of Fargo, we're going to go invade Grand Forks and to make them our vassals, and they will pay us tribute again. So that's kind of what it's like. We have these ostensibly mayors with armies, and they have some regional scope, and then they say, my army's there to enforce you paying tribute to me. So that's when it says servant. That's what they're doing. They're making them pay tribute to... I got to turn this thing off. It is Mark. It is Mark. Mom doing baby voice. Oh, okay. Any case, I better put that away. Because someone... It will get back somehow. I know. And Becky's not even here to do it, so... It'll get to Becky. I know one of you will get it to Becky, and then it will go all the way through. So in any case, the tribute is like that. So that's what it is to be a servant. And that's how the whole Middle Eastern world was set up at that time. Is that, and then city-states got bigger and bigger. And that's why when you hear about it's the Babylonians that come through. Well, Babylon wasn't a country. It was a very large city that had conquered the areas and the surrounding villages and the surrounding cities and made them vassals and servants, and that's how that happened, okay? So the only nation that doesn't work that way, that works like a nation as we understand it, would have been Egypt. Egypt was a different beast altogether, but all these other places that we're talking about all had this system of vassalage and lord, so, okay? But again, I want you to see, don't despise the small things. All right, question. We have not opened up a hornet's nest in a long time. And I'm not saying this simply because Becky's on sabbatical. You know that I greatly value Becky as a colleague, and as I've said publicly and privately, Becky is I'm proud that Becky's my pastor. I look at her as my pastor. But I'm going to ask you a question. Talk to me about women in ministry. What do you think about women in ministry? What's that? No, Joe, I'm glad that you're here. It's delighted that you're here. Heck, you could throw gas on the fire, too. It's wonderful. Talk to me. What are the things that you've heard about women in ministry? Well, what was our conversation after dinner? About you saw Liberty Lutheran Brethren and you made the comment that here's a church that they're not keen on women in ministry, are they? They're not. Well, you're being awfully quiet. We are the only two Lutheran groups in the in North America and in Mexico, for that matter, that have ordained women. Only two. Well, what else? I mean, none of you grew up in the Missouri and still wonder whether we should. No one wants to say it out loud.
It's interesting that one of the largest megachurches in the country just put a woman in as co-leadership now.
Where's that?
Willow Creek.
I did not know that. Well, that's not surprising.
They have a plan for, yeah, what's his name, to retire.
Bill Hybels. No, Willow Creek. No, Rick Warren is Saddleback, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, outside of Chicago. Well, what else did, yes?
When we lived in the Commonwealth, we were part of the Missouri.
Isn't that the most pretentious thing to say in the world, the Commonwealth? I mean, I got to admit, it really is incredibly pretentious. I'm not going to lie. Okay, yes.
We were part of the Missouri Synod Commonwealth.
Yes. Yes. Wow. That was a big deal. Okay, yeah. It was a big deal. Yep. Any other experiences like this?
3 years ago, yeah, our daughter was baptized by Pastor Terry in Enid, Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. She was fresh out of seminary, wasn't she?
Mm-hmm.
Very good pastor.
There you go. Okay, good. There's a, yeah.
We had a German Lutheran church in German settlement in Wisconsin.
German Lutheran church in a German settlement in Wisconsin. I'm not surprised by that at all.
And the women, unless they were singing, could not, like a special musical number, could not go up above a certain step.
Wow. Wow. So we have, yes, okay, yes, yes.
Well, the only thing I can really remember about my confirmation day,
mm-hmm,
was the night before we had a lesson from the altar guild on when and where we should put our gloves on and all.
Ah, the altar guild tells you when and where the lady should put their gloves on or off. Well, how about that? Okay, so we have a 33-year-old, 33 years ago, a female pastor baptism. Actually, that was a long time ago, really. She must have been one of the earlier female pastors. Yep, okay. And then we have the German community that we have them on this side and this on that. I've actually worshipped in my lifetime in a church that that was the case, that women were on one side and men were on the other. Yep, okay, all right, same as you. You've had that situation. Oh, Methodists have had women pastors for a long time. Yes, yes.
I grew up in a UCC church.
UCC church, yes.
German community.
Yep. Okay, UCC, growing up around it 26 years, okay. I'm repeating it all because Charles will chastise me severely if I don't. Yes, Gail.
When we were in the Amount of Holidays in Iowa this summer, our tour guide up for the church was a 27-year-old young woman, and she made sure we knew that this entrance was for the women's end of the church.
In the Amount of Holidays, women... Now... Who was it? There was somebody the other day wanted to put my arm in a chicken wing. It was you. It was you. You were the one that, wanted to put my about 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 6, trying to stick my arm in a chicken wing and make me cry, uncle, I didn't let you do it, did I? I told you had to wait, didn't I? Well, here's why I told you had to wait. Because. Now, for a long time, let's just say, does anybody have any idea what denomination has the most women pastors, ordained pastors? You're going to be surprised. No, not Presbyterian, not Methodist, certainly not Lutheran, not Unitarian. No. Assemblies of God, number one. Number one, a bowling trophy for you, David, bowling trophy for you. Number two, this one's an obscure one. Because people don't normally think of it as a church, but it is. Salvation Army. Salvation Army is number two. Okay. Most mainline denominations are kind of in the back. The reason why I bring this up is because there was a point in time when women in ministry was not a popular thing to talk about. I mean, it was just not a popular thing to talk about, and people would get wigged out about it and bothered about it, and it was just something that, it's just something that really bothered people because it seems to, because of what it says in 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 6. But let's take a look at what Judges chapter 4 has to say, okay?
And the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud died.
Okay, you get a good leader, the guy dies, and things fall apart.
And the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor.
Mm-hmm. Which is in the north.
The commander of his army was Sisera, mm-hmm. who lived in Harosheth Hagoyim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, then the people clean it up.
Then the people of Israel cried out to the Lord for help, for he had 900 chariots of iron.
That's a lot.
And he oppressed the people of Israel cruelly for 20 years.
Yes.
Now Deborah, a prophetess.
Okay, she's a prophetess. Okay.
The wife of Lappidoth.
Okay.
Was judging Israel at the time.
Okay.
She used to sit under the palm of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim. And the people of Israel came up to her for judgment.
Mm-hmm.
She sent and summoned Barak, the son of Abinoam, from Kadesh Naphtali.
It's also in the north.
And said to him, has not the Lord, the God of Israel, commanded you, go gather your men at Mount Tabor, mm-hmm. taking 10,000 from the people of Naphtali and the people of Zebulun? And I will draw out Sisera, the general of Jabin's army,
mm-hmm.
to meet you by the river Kishon
yes.
with his chariots
yes.
and his troops. And I will give them into your hand. Barak said to her, if you will go with me, I will go.
Mm.
But if you will not go with me, I will not go.
Mm.
And she said, I will surely go with you, Nevertheless, the road on which you are going will not lead to your glory, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman. Then Deborah arose and went with Barak to Kedesh. And Barak called out Zebulun and Naphtali to Kedesh, and 10,000 men went up at his heels, and Deborah went up with him.
Okay. Keep going.
Now Heber the Kenite had separated from the Kenites, the descendants of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses.
That's interesting.
And had pitched his tent as far away as the oak in Zaanan.
Pitched his what?
His tent.
Now that's an important little feature right there. This gentleman is a nomad. Okay, read on.
When Sisera was told that Barak, the son of Abinoam, had gone up to Mount Tabor, Sisera called out his chariots, 900 chariots of iron, and all the men who were with him.
That's a lot.
From Harosheth Hagoyim to the river Kishon. Mm-hmm. And Deborah said to Barak, "Up, for this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hand. Does not the Lord go out before you?"
Yes.
So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him, and the Lord routed Sisera.
What? The who did? The who did what?
The Lord routed.
The Lord routed Sisera. Okay, let's be clear about who's doing the routing. Okay, all right. Now, I wonder if that's a Porter Cable router or a DeWalt router.
And the Lord
a power tool joke there.
It's a Wi-Fi router. and the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army before Barak by the edge of the sword.
Mm-hmm.
And Sisera got down from his chariot and fled away on foot.
Mm.
And Barak pursued the chariots and the army of Harosheth Hagoyim. I'm sorry, to Harosheth Hagoyim, and all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword.
Mm-hmm.
Not a man was left.
Mm.
But Sisera fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite.
Not to be confused with the father of Superman. No.
For there was peace between Jabin.
That is his name, isn't it? Okay. Jarell. I'm sorry. Okay. Close enough.
For there was peace between Jabin, the king of Hazor, and the house of Heber the Kenite. And Jael came out to meet Sisera and said to him, "Turn aside, my lord. Turn aside to me. Do not be afraid." So he turned aside to her into the tent, and she covered him with a rug.
Mm.
And he said to her, "Please give me a little water to drink, for I'm thirsty." So she opened a skin of milk and gave him a drink and covered him. And he said to her, "Stand at the opening of the tent, and if any man comes and asks you, 'Is anyone here?' say, 'No.'"
Hmm.
But Jael, the wife of Heber, took a tent peg
and
took a hammer in her hand. Then she went softly to him and drove the peg into his temple until it went down into the ground. While he was
you really don't want your kids reading this. You really don't want your kids reading this. It's in the book. Okay.
So he died.
Yeah, I'd do that. That would do it. And if you were having it done, you would want that to be the end result. You would not want this tent peg sticking all the way through your skull. That would not be a good thing. No.
And behold, as Barak was pursuing Sisera, Jael went out to meet him and said to him, "Come, and I will show you the man whom you are seeking." So he went into her tent, and there lay Sisera dead with the tent peg in his temple. So on that day, God subdued Jabin, the king of Canaan, before the people of Israel, and the hand of the people of Israel pressed harder and harder against Jabin, the king of Canaan, until they destroyed Jabin, king of Canaan.
Okay. Now, this is a great story. I love this story for a lot of reasons. A couple things that are going on here. First of all, who are the men in this story? You're jumping ahead. You're anticipating my questions. They're cowards. But who are they? Jabin, okay, number one. Barak, number two. And Sisera, number three. Okay. Let's deal with Sisera first. Sisera is the general of Jabin, okay? So he's the general, and he's supposed to be the big manly man who is the general of Jabin and goes out to oppress the Israelites, okay? And Barak, that's his name, that's where it comes from. You know, people wonder, you know, as people misunderstand that people think, well, you know, his father was born into a Muslim home in Kenya, but his father actually went to a Catholic school, but his father wasn't really a Muslim. His father was a communist, self-avowed communist. People mix that up, but people, you know, unfairly, you know, have sort of painted this title on it. This is where his name comes from. It means lightning in one Semitic term. Now, oddly, we'll get to that in a second. So he's one guy, and how does he come across? Wimpy. That's a kind way to say it. I would have used some other less politically correct thing to say that people would accuse of being a microaggression. Actually, again, I have no microaggressions. I only have macroaggressions and say things which are grossly inappropriate. That's what would be said about this guy. You know, he really was pretty wimpy. I mean, he says, you know, I'll go if you go. You know, really? I mean, how utterly unmanly is this guy? I mean, he is completely painted as being totally unmanly in every way that he can be painted that way. And if you are dealing with a patriarchal society, like people often accuse the Bible of, well, guess what? This guy's a pretty poor excuse of a patriarch. A pretty poor excuse of a patriarch. So we've got this guy here. Then there's another guy. Heber. We got Sisera. Heber, we understand, is a nomad that's floating around out there. And they are sort of, they're on a good terms with the Canaanites, sort of. But he's a nomad. He lives in a tent and so forth. So what do we know about him? He's a descendant of Moses' father-in-law, Hobab. I love saying Hobab. That's just a great name. And now you've got to understand that there are about three different names for Moses' father-in-law. Hobab, Reuel, and of course my all-time favorite, Jethro. I love Jethro, as I said. You know, it comes from the time I grew up in. Anyway, I won't try that experiment, but I'm sure it would work. I'm looking at enough people in this room, and I know that they could sing the song with me. All I would need to do is start it. The next thing we want to see is the women here. Who are the she folk here? Deborah, Jael. We have a really strong contrast here. We have a strong contrast what's going on here. First of all, you've got Deborah, who is the wife of who? Lapidoth. Okay. Now, Lapidoth is another Hebrew word, and it also means lightning. Now, it either means one of two things. Either that she is married to Barak, which doesn't seem likely, or this says something about her personality. That this says something about her strength of personality, that she's a gal you don't want to mess with. Now, what does she do? She is a prophetess. Okay, so she prophesies on God's behalf, and she also does what? She judges Israel. There you go. There she is. Seems like she's large and in charge and doing a great job. And telling this guy that he's kind of a wimp and he needs to get busy about his business. And when he drags his heels, he says, okay, I'll go finally. Then what happens? She says, guess what? You might go, but you're not going to get any glory from this. One of my sisters will. Okay? One of my sisters will. Well, who is this sister? JL. Now, she's an interesting character. Let's kind of look at her behavior. She says to Mr. Cicero, who, by the way, is running with his tail between his legs after being defeated and hiding and wants to... You know, and again, I don't mean to bring up stereotypes, but he kind of wants to hide under his mother's skirt, so to speak. He goes looking to hide in a woman's tent, which is kind of unmanly. I mean, let's just be... in this world, it's just an unmanly thing to do. Come on, go out there and be a Klingon about this, you know? Go out there and, you know, it's a good day to die, for crying out loud. I love the Klingons, man. They're great. Anyway, he's anything but. He's anything but. He's kind of unmanly. He goes and he says, I want you to hide me. I want to hide behind you. And what does he do? She sticks a blanket or a rug or something around him, gets him nice and toasty, and he wants some water, and what'd she give him? Slips him a Mickey. I am reminded of the great scene in Young Frankenstein where Cloris Leachman asks, "Vor Milk? Ovaltine?" In any case, great scene. But the idea is that Ovaltine or warm milk was going to knock you out. And that's, you know, that's what she does. She slips him a Mickey, so to speak. I mean, gets him nice and toasty in the underneath that rug, gives him some milk that'll not give him a false sense of whatever, and off to La La Land he goes. And what does she do next? Boy, I'm going to tell you something. She's mean. I'm telling you something. I don't want to mess with her. I don't want to meet her in a dark alley if she's mad at me, because I got to tell you something. I don't think I'd be coming out. She is a strong W-O-M-A-N. Tell me again. Absolutely. She takes that peg. Where did she think she learned to do that? Guess who's setting the tent up? Guess who's setting the tent up, guys? Yeah, really, she is. Remember I told you they traveled about in tents? That's not an extra little piece of information that's there for nothing. It kind of lets us know something that's going to happen. She takes that tent peg and... pops it right there, and you can imagine, it's just one strike, and he's done. Pins him to the ground. I mean, pins him. I mean, she's bad to the bone. You could hear George Thorogood saying there, yes, you may ask a question. In 21. Okay. Yes, he went softly to him. That really is good, because he sort of... Yet softly went to him and drove the tent peg into his temple. A little bit of irony there, isn't it? But again, it's there. You're around the campfire. You hear this, and you're laughing uproariously. You're laughing at these two nitwits, Barak and Sisera, and then you're just loving these two gals. I mean, you're thinking they're the greatest. Yeah, this is wonderful. This is marvelous. I have to look it up. I've not seen it. I'll have to. That's pretty neat, though. I like that. I think that's pretty wild. The word softly, that's pretty wild. So in any case, we have that going on, and it's pretty amazing right here. Then, if you're not into narrative, if you're not into the story aspect of it, anybody like songs? You like ballads and people singing about songs? You know, there are all kinds of songs that that tell stories. Well, guess what? Chapter 5 is a song. We won't go through it all, but it does have some funny things in it that are kind of humorous along the way. Towards the end, they're talking about some women in here, you know, what's going on here. And let's turn to, let's go to chapter 5, verse 24. We got that one there? 5:24.
Most blessed of women be Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, of tent-dwelling women, most blessed.
Yes.
He asked for water, and she gave him milk. She brought him curds in a noble's bowl. She sent her hand to her tent peg and her right hand to the workman's mallet. She struck Sisera. She crushed his head. She shattered and pierced his temple. Between her feet he sank. He fell. He lay still. Between her feet he sank. He fell. Where he sank, there he fell. Dead. Out of the window she peered. The mother of Sisera wailed through the lattice. Why is his chariot so long in coming? Why tarry the hoofbeats of his chariot? Her wisest princesses answer. Indeed, she answers herself. Have they not found and divided the spoil? A womb for two for every man? Spoil of dyed materials.
A womb for two. I love that. A womb for two. In the English, the New English Bible, you know the one that had the once upon a time in it? Do you know what it says here? A wench or two. Yar, matey. Anyway. Can you say wench anymore? Am I allowed to say wench?
Yes.
If I'm talking about cars, I suppose I could say a wench. There you go. Yeah.
That's a winch.
A winch. Oh. A witch? No, no, no. See, there's the line right there. I'm going to go right up to it. I didn't write that. Someone else wrote that. I'm just repeating it. That's all. Okay, read on.
Spoil of dyed materials for Sisera. Spoil of dyed materials embroidered. Two pieces of dyed work embroidered for the necklace spoil. So may all your enemies perish, O Lord. But your friends be like the sun as he rises in his might. And the land had rest for 40 years.
Okay. There's a pattern developing in the book of Judges. And it's an interesting pattern that you don't see in the book of Joshua. You don't see it so much in Exodus through Deuteronomy. You saw the pattern a little bit in Genesis, but there's a distinct pattern developing. Women are starting to come to the forefront in the narrative. The first one we encountered last week. Remember Aksa? You know, the gal that alights from her donkey? And remember her? She's kind of the heroine. And then all of a sudden we see this gal, Deborah. And we see Jael. And now we see this victory from a woman's perspective. First of all, the mother fretting where her son is. Okay. Then the princesses, so plural of princesses, are saying, don't worry about things. You know, they're out just, dare I say, boys will be boys. That's what they're doing. They're out wenching. Well, that's what happened. I mean, I'm just saying. And she, mom is being told by these girls, don't worry, you know how guys are. They're just out, you know, wenching with the local girls that they've just conquered. That's what's going on there. So you see this influence of the female perspective on what's going on in the world. It's going to get a little bit more increased. What I want to point out is this, is that the book of Judges takes on a particularly feminine perspective. A particularly feminine perspective. You've got a woman who is, in fact, the judge and leader of Israel at the time. And, you know, I know people will argue with me about this and get all bent out of shape and so forth, but I think it's pretty clear what's going on here. People will try to come up with various sort of constructs as to why this was an exception and this, that, and the other. And who knows, maybe that's true, but all I'm saying is this book has a decidedly feminine point of view in it. It's also got a comical point of view in it. It's got a point of irony in it. It's a dark comedy at times. And the dark comedy here is this, is that we know the truth, okay? We know the truth. But the people in the song don't know the truth. And so they're acting and saying one thing, but we know just the opposite. And so it's a very dark comedy, a very dark sort of thing about what's going on here. But I think it's important for us to see a few things here, some stuff that we can learn from all this, that the decisive leadership of Deborah is pretty impeccable. I mean, she is a decisive leader, and there's a lot that we can learn about this. Here's a woman who's a prophetess, so that means her decisiveness comes from her connectedness to God. It's not that she's just a strong woman leader, and you know, we need a strong woman leader. That's not it at all. We need a strong woman leader that's connected to God, okay, or any leader for that matter. But I'm just saying is that in this particular case, she's not just simply a strong woman or a woman that's difficult to get along with, because they could probably be chuckling about that too in the around the campfire. It's a woman who is definitely connected to the Word of God, connected to God through prophecy. That's an important piece in all this. So there you have that. Any questions or observations or thoughts or other perspectives on our friends Deborah and JL and all the other people in this particular thing?
Kind of a mystery. He's sleeping under a rug, and yet he falls and sinks to the ground.
Falls and sinks, a mystery.
I thought he was pinned to the ground.
Well, again, poetic license in the... he doesn't eat curds either. It says that he brought curds in a royal bro. Yeah, they just... Yeah, well... Now we're nitpicking now there, Daniel. but in any case, yeah. Well, I still think, you know, she's bad to the bone, man. One stroke, she's got that arm going on. I would not want to arm wrestle this lady right here. Not a chance. Other observations? Pardon? They did God's evil. They did God's business. Again, is it evil to cut cancer out? You know, if I have cancer, I want those cancer cells cut out of me. There's no two ways about it. I don't want those cancer cells. Yeah, they're a part of me. I mean, I produced them, right? I mean, did I not produce those cancer cells? I did. Are they not Paul Cross's DNA? Yes, they are. You know what I want? I want those suckers cut out of me. Plain and simple. So, that's how I look at it. I mean, here you have, again, we've talked about last week, the cancer that is what's going on here. The more we read in this, the more we find out that all the baby burning and all the stuff that goes with it is continues to go on as it does. And Israel's going to start doing it. You know why? Because they didn't cut out the cancer. You don't cut out the cancer, guess what it's going to do? It's going to grow. It's going to consume. That's what cancer does. I don't know if you are aware of that or not, but it does. It's nasty stuff. It's really nasty stuff.
It's also kind of a high-tech versus, like you said, the native arts.
Yes.
A tent stake.
Mm-hmm. Versus 900 chariots.
Yeah, and the goading stick.
And the goading stick,
versus
again.
Those wonderful iron-rimmed chariots, yeah, of this mighty empire.
Correct. There is a contrast between the general who had 900 chariots, iron chariots, with the army to go with it, is brought down by a tent peg. Again, low tech. So, another thing. Gail.
So, if Gail's husband was friendly with Jacob.
Yes. Yes.
He wasn't fighting.
Yes.
Where was?
Okay, if Jael's husband, Heber, was he was friendly with, yeah, where was he on all this? You know, which of course leads to the thing is what, if not murder, what crime is Jael guilty of? I think it would be treason, wouldn't you say? Because supposedly they're on the same team. But again, just like Rahab, by the way, remember her? Again, another female who was a Canaanite. Rahab sees, God is not blessing what these guys are doing. I need to take measures to be in the thing that God is blessing. Now, I'm not advocating tent pegs or anything like that. As I said, I better be careful around y'all. You might start taking tent pegs up, and who knows what might be happening. If I see mallets in any of your hands, I'll know what you're up to. But again, she realizes what her husband's been involved with this other yo-yo is not a good thing. I'm gonna do the right thing. Good question. Yes. Only Barak and Deborah. Okay, the JL and Heber are Midianites or Kenites, which is kind of a tribe. It kind of blurs together. They're They're Abrahamic, but from Keturah. Keturah was Abraham's third wife. When Abraham's a really old guy, he gets himself a young gal and has a bunch of kids, and these people are all from that group. They tend to be nomad, extended family. Well, this you will recall back in Genesis, remember when Joseph gets sold into slavery? And they think, well, what a terrible thing for his brothers to do. What do you mean, what a terrible thing for his brothers to do? These are his cousins, and they know who they are. They know who it is that they're selling into slavery. This is nonsense. I mean, I think I demonstrated the consanguinity of Joseph and the Ishmaelites and Joseph and the Midianites. I mean, the consanguinity, the blood closeness of these. Again, we're talking maybe first cousins, twice removed, something like that. So it's like, and this is the ancient Near East. They know who this guy is. So these people are distantly related, but they're of the Abrahamic division. The Canaanites, on the other hand, Jabin, Sisera, those people are Canaanites, okay? Those people are not ethnically related. They're the people who are there in the central highlands. Now, just to kind of give you, you know, one day I will get my act together, but it'll be in heaven, and I'll have all the PowerPoints that I need. I'll just sort of, I'll think them, and they'll appear on the screen in the back. That's how it's going to work in heaven. That's my, again, your idea of hell, my idea of heaven. Nevertheless, if you were to look in the north, there is that, again, this is a green area. Don't think beige, think green. Well-watered, fertile, and well-fortified, because it's right on that plain that kind of sweeps down to that choke point at Megiddo. Remember we talked about Megiddo, Armageddon, that choke point right there. That's why he's got chariots, because he can fight in that plain like that. And so Hazor is up there in the north part of it. And he's kind of got the control of the northern part of Canaan. So those are Canaanites there. But the other ones are not. Yeah. Right, exactly. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, but the only people who are Israelites are Barak and Deborah. Okay. Yes. No, but they're in league with them. The Midianites, are the Midianites the same thing as the Canaanites? It's kind of hard. I mean, it's like they play both sides of the team here, you know. This is kind of, the Midianites are the ones that sort of get everybody, just as they're getting ready to cross over into the Promised Land. Who is it that messes them up with all the sex business? It's the Midianites, Cosby and her and all that sort of stuff. They make to have the sex kebab. Remember the sex kebab? You didn't think I'd honestly say that again after saying it the first time. But, well, that's what it is. I mean, that's what happened. I mean, what else would you call two people copulating held together with a spear? I mean, that's what it was doing. I mean, but the Midianites were the ones that were doing that. They were trying to seduce them. But on the other hand, guess who? Moses is married to a Midianite. So, go figure. That the Midianites descend from Abraham, that's correct.
Abraham descended from Shem, and the Canaanites did.
The Canaanites did not descend from Shem. Now, of course, there's a lot of arguments about this, because technically they're a Semitic people, but no, they descended from Ham. The Canaanites are descendants of Ham, which is making me hungry.
There was criticism in the paper.
There's criticism in the paper about the new Bible Museum opening in Washington, D.C., done by the people, Hobby Lobby. Not much about Jesus.
Not much really about God.
Not much about God.
Stories like what we're reading here.
Yes.
They have all these displays and things that are so fascinating, like a National Geographic version of
A National Geographic version. Yeah. This, with regard to the Bible Museum in Washington, D.C., okay. Let me just say this about that. It was done by the people who own Hobby Lobby. They provided all the money for it. It's very expensive to do this. It's controversial on a number of levels. On the one hand, it's controversial by all the people who hate the Bible, who just think this is the most evil thing in the world for us to have a museum for the Bible in the nation's capital. It's a private museum. Stick it in your ear, okay? Sorry. Did I say that out loud? I did. I'm really tired of such nonsense. It's just incredibly stupid. But, you know, the next thing people are going to come in here and say, you know, you can't say those rotten things, Pastor, because you're, you know, promoting hate speech, this, that, and the other thing, or whatever it is that I'm doing wrong. And, you know, there's ample evidence of things. I mean, we got a room full of people who could testify about the things that I do wrong so on a regular basis. But, you know, this is private, so those people over there, they've got nothing to gripe about. Too bad. Raise your own money. Get your own anti-Bible museum, if that's what you want to do. So that's the one group over there. Then there's another group that are complaining because they're a little snooty, and they're a little jealous because this guy's got cash to buy artifacts that they don't have. And they say, well, this thing's not properly curated. You know, they put their little pinky up in the air, and they use the word curate. That's a new hip word, by the way, to curate something. I just love that, when I see hipsters using the word curated. That's just hilarious. Absolutely. I've curated beard wax, and whatever that means. It sounds like something a hipster would say. But beard oil, excuse me, not beard wax, pardon me. How last century that is. Anyway, so that's the other group. Then you've got people that are hyper-Christian. And these are the people that think you should only be reading the King James Bible, that you should own that this, that, and the other thing, and that you'll never be more Christian than they are. So these poor folks have got it coming from all angles, okay? They've got it coming from all angles. I think it's kind of an interesting thing. Anything that helps people understand the roots of how the Bible came into being as a human book is not a bad thing. Christians oftentimes get nervous talking about the Bible as a human book because they think that it's only a human book and that the critics will only say that it's only a human book, that it's not a divine book. We don't believe that. In my spiffy, handy-dandy catechism, it tells me that I believe that Jesus Christ, true God, Son of the Father from eternity, and true man born of the Virgin Mary is my Lord. This is a mystery of faith, that Jesus is not 50% God and 50% human, or mostly human and a little bit of God, that he is fully God and fully human, merged together, and we hold this intention. You know I love it when I do this. We hold this intention that this is a mystery held in tension, fully God, fully human. We also believe the same thing about the Scriptures, that the Scriptures are fully a human book and fully a divinely inspired book. Both, fully both. It's a mystery. We do not believe, as the Mormons believe, that there were these golden tablets that dropped down out of the sky. We don't believe that. It's not true. We don't believe like the Muslims believe that all of a sudden this thing came down and boom, there it happens. We don't believe that. We believe this is a fully human book, but it's also a fully inspired book. And we hold that intention because it's the Word of God, just like Jesus is the Word of God. Jesus is the incarnate Word of God, and the Scriptures are the written Word of God. And this is how that happens. We hold those two things in tension. Don't ever let go of one, because if you let go of one, you're going to wind up in the ditch. Ever driven in the ditch? When I was telling my children how to drive, they were always afraid of going over into the crossing the double yellow line. I would try to, and they would drive close to the ditch. I would remind them that there is just as much that can wreck your car in the ditch as there is coming the other way on the highway. It's the truth. Having been a claims adjuster, I can tell you that that is the God's honest truth. There's every bit as much can wreck the car over there as over there. You want to drive down the center, you want to get like this. You want center of the lane, okay? And that's what fully God, fully human helps us do. This simply explains, this, from my understanding, the
controversy.
Well, the controversy, you know, that, you know, if we actually, you know, do you know why I don't broadcast this stuff? If we broadcast, can you imagine the heat that this congregation would take just for having a nut job like me saying the things that I do all the time, every weekend here? Boy, people, there'd be somebody up in arms about me and say, goodness gracious, keep this a secret. Keep it under the wraps. Don't let anybody know about what's going on in here. But yes, I've not been to that museum yet, by the way. There's a cooler thing in Washington, D.C., in the Folger Library. One of the original copies, one of the oldest copies of the New Testament. It's called Codex Washingtonius. Imagine that. That's a novel name for you. In Washington, D.C., Codex Washingtonius is found in the Freer Library, and it's amazing. I mean, it's an amazing original, well, not original, old copy of the Greek New Testament. So, yeah. But guess what? We're going to see something cool when we go on our field trip. Don't forget our field trip. When's the field trip? Anybody remember? 15. November 15th. That's right. Our field trip. It's $10. And we'll be going over to the... Somebody say it. Yumkunst. You know, my Ford has finally learned to pronounce Bjertness. Seriously. I'd say when I use the MySync whatever it is on the thing, and I'd speak a phone number in there, and it would say it would really butcher Pastor Bjertness's name over at First Lutheran. But over time, it actually learns how to do it. And the other day, it said it like it was Norwegian, and I said, I need to have an exorcist come and cast this Norwegian out of my car's computer. Absolutely. So, the Hjelmkamp Center, or whatever. Did I say it right? Hjelmkamp. That is going to be on the 15th. Go to the highways. We'll get a sign-up sheet next week. Oh, next week. We will not be meeting next week. I apologize. The reason why we won't be meeting next week is that I'm not afraid of NDEA week. I'm not afraid of MEA week. Let the teachers' union do their worst, for crying out. No. God bless the teachers' union. But I am not going to go against the spooktacular. That would be a little hard to go against. We're having the spooktacular next week, which is where we have the cars. And I would encourage each and every one of you to have a car out there loaded up with fancy stuff and all that sort of stuff. Make it Reformation themed. Do something. Yeah, why not? Yeah. Have a brewery in your trunk. That would be Reformation themed, wouldn't it? I mean, Katie Luther was an excellent broom mistress, I would say. She was. True story. Absolutely. So we say that we're giving cans of beer, maybe to the adults. No, you know what? If we were in Texas, I think that would be okay, but we're not in Texas, so I think it's not okay. You know, it is funny, but, you know, the things that you do in one place are okay, and things that you do in another, like, you know, there it's okay to have beer. Here it's okay to have fish soaked in poison. I mean, you know, what's up with that? I mean, why would you feed somebody fish soaked in poison? I wouldn't do that to my friends in 1,000 years. I'd much rather give them a beer. So, you know, but again, people think that that's okay to do up here. I don't understand that for the life of me. I'm sorry. I did. I did tell you the story about my first Sunday with the barbecue committee. They were making barbecue breakfast, breakfast tacos for me when I first showed up there. And there were the smokehouse, a good-sized smokehouse. I mean, about like that. That's not an exaggeration. About like that. Four pits working, four pits not operative yet. But there at 7 in the morning on Sunday morning, the smokestacks are pumping out the smoke, and there are 14 pickup trucks around the smokehouse. This is just behind the church building. And I walk up, and only one of the 14 gentlemen at 7 o'clock in the morning bothers to hide his beer from the pastor. One. They're Germans, and it's in Texas, and that's just kind of how they see the world. Again, they would no more think about poisoning their guests with fish that's been poisoned to save their lives. They would never think to do something like that. But, you know, different custom here. So I'm just kidding. You can have as much lutefisk as you want. You can even have my share. Please take my share. I like the little round brown lutefisks. Those little round brown lutefisks are great. I love those. The little round, you know, the little brown lutefisk?
Swedish meatballs.
Oh, that's what they're called. I thought they were little round brown lutefisks. I'll have all the little brown round lutefisks you can put on my plate. So anyway. Well, you know, I wish I could tell you good, but my successor lasted only 18 months. Yeah, he just resigned and was not a pleasant sight. So, not a pleasant sight. It would be. I would like to tell you otherwise. Yeah, that's always hard when you hear things like that. You want things to go well, but I don't think it has anything to do with the smoke shack, though. You know, we've got 5 minutes left. What mayhem and nonsense can I get involved in that? It's a little bit early to be talking about. Let me give you a reading assignment. Read through chapter 12 for next time, 6 through 12. We're going to be looking at the lives of mostly Gideon, and we think of Gideon. What do you think of? Gideon Bibles. And I've tried to find out why they use the name Gideon, because I think I have a pretty good handle on trying to understand what people represent and the stories and so forth, but I don't know why they would choose the word Gideon, or the name Gideon, to be representative of their business, or their, it's not a business, it's an endeavor. I don't know why they would use that name. But read that. It talks a lot about Gideon, but there's also a really sad one in there too, but that's neither here nor there. So,
numbers again, 6 through 12.
Other observations? Any questions? Anybody got? Margene, weren't you going to ask me some question? You were supposed to ask me a question that I was going to answer, but I didn't want to answer just for you.
Okay.
Margene has a question. So a discussion with some Yahoo. Are you sure it wasn't a Google?
It wasn't the Google machine.
Okay.
And we were talking about...
This Yahoo we're talking about...
It's in John.
John.
Chapter. About snakes.
Oh, no, it's in Mark 16.
Mark 16.
Mark 16. Well, look, turn there. Mark 16, verses 9 through 20. Mark 16, 9 through 20. You got that one back there? Because you got the microphone, because I will be running out of town on a rail if this is not recorded. Margene is wondering about snakes.
Now, when he rose early on the first day of the week...
No, rose early on the first day.
He appeared first to Mary Magdalene.
Mary Magdalene, we named a church like that.
From whom he had cast out 7 demons.
Yes.
She went and told those who had been with him as they mourned and wept.
Yes.
But when they heard that he was alive and had been seen by her, they would not believe it. After these things, he appeared in another form to 2 of them as they were walking into the country. And they went back and told the rest, but they did not believe them.
Nope.
Afterward, he appeared to the 11 themselves as they were reclining at table, and mm-hmm. he rebuked them for their unbelief and mm-hmm. hardness of heart. Because they had not believed those who saw him after he had risen.
Yeah.
And he said to them, go into all the world and proclaim the gospel to the mm-hmm. whole creation.
Yep.
Whoever believes and is baptized will be saved.
Now stop right there. Whoever believes and will be baptized will be saved. Keep going.
But whoever does not believe will be condemned.
Now, for those of you who grew up in a good Lutheran church with a decent Lutheran pastor, not like the guy you got here, who actually made kids memorize the catechism, you would note that that little snippet right there, that little sound bite, appears in Luther's Small Catechism. That little sound bite. But does he put the rest of it in there? Does he put the context? Read on. So if you believe and you're baptized, you'll be saved. But if you don't believe, you'll be condemned. Read on.
And these signs will accompany those who believe in my name.
Wow.
They will cast out demons.
Cast out demons.
They will speak in new tongues.
Speak as he tongues, wee.
They will pick up serpents with their hands.
Pick up serpents with their hands.
And if they drink any deadly poison, it will not hurt them.
Mm-hmm.
They will lay their hands on the sick, and they will recover.
Now, Margene, what is your question?
I like to think.
You like to think. Correct.
But I don't do snakes.
You don't do snakes.
I don't drink poison.
And you don't drink poison.
I have never, ever spoken in a new tongue, speaking to tongue,
wee-wee.
And I don't lay my hands on anybody. I've never had that experience.
Okay, well, you might not have ever had that experience. Now, a snake is a...
icky thing.
Yeah, but it's all more technically, it's a reptile. Dinosaurs are reptiles. Are dinosaurs mentioned in the Bible? Funny you should ask, but on Saturday the 20th, she knows where I'm going with this. On Saturday the 28th, for kids, say, fifth grade through the seventh grade, some fifth grader asked me, how come he doesn't believe in dinosaurs because they're not mentioned in the Bible. And he asked, where are the dinosaurs in the Bible? So at 9 o'clock in the morning on Saturday the 28th, we're going to have, you're going to love this, Jurassic Paul. Seriously, I'm not making that up. Jurassic Paul. Oh, we got this new gal on staff, Sarah DeYoung, no relation to the DeYoung families that are members here, but Sarah DeYoung, she's just a wizard, and she came up with this thing, and it just made me, I mean, I almost lost control. I laughed so much when I saw it. It's so funny.
It will be on the screen.
It will be on the screen on Sunday, so you don't want to miss church because of that. Eating lutefisk could be a sign of, yes. I don't know whether to give you the bowling trophy or the Homer trophy for that day.
I do the meatballs.
You know, in answer to your question, this, of course, is one of the great mysteries of the Bible, and there is no satisfactory answer. And now she's thinking to herself, you made me wait a week to say that. Yeah, well, I made you wait a week to say that. There, you know, there are groups in the Appalachians that indeed handle rattlesnakes, cottonmouths, copperheads, water moccasins. You really don't want to do that. It's a bad idea. In Seguin, Seguin is one of the few places in the United States where the five poisonous snakes that are found in North America are indigenous to the same place. There are cottonmouths there, there are water moccasins, there are copperheads, and there are rattlesnakes, and yes, there are also coral snakes. All of them are indigenous to Guadalupe County. The Guadalupe Hospital down there has one of the best repositories of antivenom of any place in the United States. So if you do get bitten by a snake, you really don't want to be terribly far from the hospital there because it's got a great depository of snake venom. Yeah, not suppositories. Yeah, I think I'll take my options with the bite. I'll take my chances with that.
So in other words, what you're saying, Paul...
No, I'm not saying anything. I'm stopping talking right now. Someone else has got to pray. Actually, North Dakota, there are rattlesnakes that are... Rattlesnakes are indigenous to North Dakota. Actually, rattlesnakes are indigenous to all lower 48. They're not indigenous to the Alaska or Hawaii, but rattlesnakes are indigenous to all 48. You know, people talk about, well, what should be the national animal because, you know, the bald eagle's not indigenous to all the places. The only animal that's indigenous to more places is indigenous to 49, including Alaska, is the skunk. The skunks are indigenous to all 49 states on the continent. So anyway, but back to snakes.
Back to the Bible.
And back to strychnine. But in these cults, they will handle snakes, and they will also drink strychnine.
And then they will die.
They'll get really sick. Okay. They'll get really
so
sick.
So in other words, what you're telling me is...
Don't tempt fate. Don't tempt God. No, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is this, is that, you know, I believe in the power of God in a very implicit way. I certainly, you know, have witnessed the whole notion of speaking in tongues. You know, people getting demonic possession, deliverance from that. Sure, I buy into all that. What I'm saying is this, is that if something happens to you and you're in a remote place, all kinds of great things can happen if you're in God's will, because God has a shield of protection about you. But don't go tempting fate by things like that. That's silliness. That's pure silliness. Don't go try for the theatrics. That's not what that's about, okay? All right. I believe in the power of God. Yeah. Yes, Gail. That's what I was saying. Yeah. This is in West Virginia. Yeah. And you know. So, Oh, they, oh yeah, this is, I mean, people really do this stuff. It is, curiously enough, illegal. I mean, there are very, 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 very few religious practices that the government will come down on. Snake handling is one of them, because it is considered to be a public health hazard.
But isn't this in the tense given will?
Yeah, I know.
Will, this is a sign of something accompanied by these strange...
Sure, things. Yeah.
That's one more sign of the end times.
Not the end times. The sign of you being an authentic believer. That's what it says.
Well, then...
Yeah, that's, and by the way, that's why they do it. Because they want to be shown to be authentic believers. Now, see, there's nothing in Judges that got this interesting kind of conversation going. I tried to rabble-rouse you up with women in ministry, but that didn't work. You're too wise for that. You're fascinated by snakes. Again, if you want to find about snakes in the Bible, I mean, reptiles in the Bible.
Remember Moses' staff.
Yeah.
Ceases being a snake as an important sign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you look to it for healing.
Yes.
Yeah. Nehushtan. Now, that comes later. That's different. The caduceus, is that right? Is that the name of it, the caduceus? I think that's what it's called, the little staff with the twin snakes. See, the Moses staff is just a single snake. But I think it's called a caduceus. I could be wrong about that. It was two snakes, and they also throw some wings on top of that sometimes as well. That's a symbol of healing in the Greek philosophical world, Greek mythology. Yes.
But isn't it important to recognize that this passage from Mark 16 is the most disputed?
Yes. Now there you go. As I said, now we're going to go over to our friendly Bible museum.
Say that again.
The passage in Mark 16, verses 9 through 20, if you take a look at your footnotes in the Bible, it is alleged to be the most disputed part of the New Testament. Without going into a lot of discussion about this. Okay. Real quickly, the poorest of the poor of the poor of the poor of the poor were the followers of Jesus, and it was an outlaw bunch. So that means, guess what? You're not going to have access to good technology, so you're going to write these things down on the back of a piece of wax paper, on the back of a lunch bag. You're going to write these things on what you've got, okay? You don't get to write all these things down on vellum or fancy calfskin or anything like that. You don't get to have scribes do this. Because you're an outlaw bunch, all right? So you're writing this stuff down as best as you can. And then pass it on to the next guy, and pass it on to the next guy, and pass it on to the next guy. Okay? So now let's be clear about the human side of how the New Testament comes into being, all right? I should do a class on this sometime. But really, it's fascinating. But it takes a while before our team wins. Or at least gets the upper hand, or at least, you know, is ahead on the scoreboard. And that is about 325 A.D. Well, that's a long time since Jesus was around. That's almost little under 300 years. There's a lot of fragments, a lot of stuff on papyrus of the New Testament from that time. But the stuff getting the good stuff on the parchments, which is leather, doesn't really kick in until about 325. That's when it really kicks into getting on these scrolls. By this time, there are variants. Now, this bothers some people to say that they're variant pieces of parts of the Gospel of Mark. They're not big things, okay? This is one of the big things. This and the woman caught in adultery are the two big things. That's the one in John's Gospel, John 7:59 through 8:12. That's the other big one that people that look at, that there's not as many ancient manuscripts that point in that direction. Most ancient manuscripts of Mark's gospel end with verse 8. Let's read that. You want to read that? This is fascinating.
And they went out and fled from the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had seized them, and they said nothing to anyone.
The end.
They were afraid.
They were afraid. The end. Do you think Mark's gospel really ends there? No. Now, the ending of Mark has always been a big question about how is this supposed to end. There's a lot of discussion about this, I mean, we could have a very long, I would need my heavenly PowerPoint slides to get up there to explain all this stuff. But most manuscripts of Mark end that way. There's some that have a very short verse tacked on at the end, and then a very few manuscripts have this 9 through 20 tacked on. Now, what 9 through 20 is, if you take a look at it carefully, 9 through 20 is a compilation of everything that the Gospels, all four Gospels say. You can find something from each of the four Gospels in that 9 through 20. Some people suggest that it was, okay, do you want to listen to this? I mean, we could go home, because we could go, I don't want to go too much longer on this. Julie's egging me on. She always does this. Go, go. Okay. The theory that I subscribe to is that the first gospel written was the Gospel of Matthew. Matthew wrote it, and it was for the Jews. The second gospel written was Luke. It was written for the Greeks. Luke wrote it as the gospel that Paul carried with him as he carried Luke with him. Okay? And that's kind of the next concentric missionary circle out. This is not a theory that a lot of people like, but it's the one I like. The next gospel written, the next concentric circle out, is Mark's gospel. Mark's gospel is the shortest. Mark has a lot of affinity to Matthew, a lot of affinity to Matthew, and a lot of affinity to Luke. None to John whatsoever, hardly at all. But it's short. Do you know why CEOs and executives don't like guys like me? I talk too much. A CEO, an executive, wants what's called an executive summary. Just give me the high points and then tell me what your solution's going to be. And that's what Mark is. Some suggest that Mark was five sermons, and you can see where the breaks are if you look carefully, five sermons on Jesus using Luke's gospel and Mark's gospel preached by Peter to the Roman nobility with Mark as his secretary writing all this down. Then what happens is this, and that John's gospel happens a long time later, and John writes it to a larger concentric circle out there. Let's not worry about John. Then what happens is many years later, people keep asking Mark to reproduce his gospel, and then he writes this ending at the end many years later, which includes stuff from John, from Matthew, Luke, and Mark. I'm sorry, I don't know any more about that. Let me tell you something. In answer to your question, Margene, people have been disputing the longer ending of Mark for centuries, and for me to think that I have a definitive answer for you would be the height of arrogance. Not for you asking, but for me thinking that I have the answer.
That's a,
it's a fancy way of saying I don't know. It is interesting. But again, if you want to find out reptiles, you know, come to the thing about Jurassic Paul, about dinosaurs in the Bible. So.
There are many, many interesting conversations that go on in the office Monday through Friday.
We do have them. We have many of them. Now we need to have one with God saying thank you for tonight. So let's pray. Thank you for tonight, God. We are grateful for so many things. We're grateful for your word. We're grateful for the example that you give, even amidst difficult things for us to understand, even amidst all the violence and the challenging thoughts that are in the Bible. We know that you are present, and we want to be where you walk in blessing. So help us to walk in what you are blessing, in Jesus' name.